Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and foster care. I am Dawn Davenport. I'm the host of this show, as well as the director of the nonprofit Creating a Family. Our mission at Creating a Family is to support, educate, and help adoptive, foster, and kinship families and the professionals who support them. But before I jump into that, I have a favor to ask. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher or Spotify or whatever app you're using to listen to this podcast and give us a rating. It could be a star rating, it could be a comment if you're feeling particularly generous. That's how people find about this show. And our mission is to, as I said, to help prepare families and to educate families. So we interview experts on every topic you could imagine, and we want others who are thinking about these, the areas of adoption, foster, and kinship care to know about us. So please help us out and spread the word. Today, we're going to be talking about typical behaviors of children adopted internationally. We'll be talking with Leah Strom. She is a social worker who has worked in child welfare for nearly 20 years. She is the director of social work for international and domestic adoption at the Children's Home Society and Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota. Welcome, Leah. Thanks for joining us today to talk about this topic.
Hi, Dawn. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. So we say, and we say it a lot, that international adoption now is largely a special needs adoption program. But what do we mean by that? I think we say it so often that we don't necessarily realize that the people listening, the families who are doing the adopting, may not understand what we mean.
Sure. Yeah, that term really is used a lot. And I think essentially what it's ultimately saying is that any child adopted internationally right now will have some form of need. Sometimes it's a very minor, perhaps a medical need. It can range anywhere from something very minor to maybe perhaps significant medical or emotional challenges of the child. So the primary thing is that years ago it was common, perhaps for people to adopt a very young child, perhaps 2-3 months old, that would come with no identified needs. But now that does not happen. So I think that's where that term sort of came from.
So what are some of the general characteristics and needs of kids awaiting international adoption now?
You know, it really depends a lot on the program, but most programs right now, the children, simply by the fact of their age, really, I think the youngest child that would come to the U.S. now really is more toddler age. And so it's common for, if they were to have multiple caregivers, they perhaps would have some initial challenges right as they enter the home. And there are medical issues, perhaps sometimes perhaps they have maybe some physical differences. And so it really is depends more on the country that the child is coming from, what their early experiences have been in terms of what that care looked like.
All right, so let's talk about some of the factors that will influence the behaviors of kids adopted internationally. You alluded to one of them, which is institutionalization, which is another word for orphanage or some type of group care setting. It's not universal. There are some countries that have children in foster care, but by and large, most children, even if they're currently in a foster home, have spent some time in institutionalized care. And that can mean a lot of things. Multiple caretakers. Oftentimes there's not they'll have, the evening shift, the morning shift. Sometimes they don't necessarily have the same caretaker caring for the same children. So even throughout the day, there could be multiple caregivers. Neglect is another common thing. Mm-hmm. And also these children they've been removed in some way from their birth families, which also, especially if they had lived with their birth families for a while, is traumatic in itself. So does the length of time in an institution impact the psychological and the physical development of children?
It does. Yes, absolutely. That's definitely an impact. Another thing too is the age of the child, like you had mentioned earlier, at the time that they'd entered care. So You're right. There are multiple caregivers. Most orphanages and caretakers really, truly do their best and care very much. It's just that there are many kids to perhaps one caregiver. And so the best way to ensure that each child gets what they need is to have a very strict sort of routine and schedule. For example, children eat at 9 o'clock a.m. Well, some kids aren't hungry at 9 a.m., but in order to ensure that every child can get those needs, they have a very, you know, strict schedule. And we also know that developmental ages of the child, that can really have an impact on how they grow, how they see caregivers. They may not be able to have the right or the amount of stimulation that we might want a child to have in terms of eye contact and play and things like that. So those definitely do have an impact on the long-term development of a child.
Right, just by virtue of the fact that they are one of many being cared for by many.
Exactly.
How common in your experience is abuse, either for children being adopted internationally, to have been abused either in their family of birth or in the orphanage or the institutionalized setting?
Yeah, that's a hard question, but the best way for us to prepare any family, we say, is to assume that there has been some sort of abuse or neglect. Not to say and accuse any caregivers of anything, but it's best to assume at some point in that child's life, there may have been an inappropriate reaction, observation of something. And the reason it's so important is so that once the child comes, adoptive parents are really able to meet the needs of that child. So we do work hard and have our families make the assumption that yes, likely your child has had some sort of experience of some sort of abuse. I hesitate to say it's common, but again, the best thing is to over-prepare prospective adoptive parents for that in case that their child has had that experience.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about neglect. Because sure. I think we often will lump abuse and neglect together. We do that when we're speaking of children from foster care. But in fact, the impact can be different. And I think neglect is something that is pretty common in children having come from an institutionalized setting, if for no other reason that there are many children, and usually even in the best of institutions or orphanages, the adult-child ratio is seldom what we would hope. And so let's talk a little about the neglect and how it can impact children adopted internationally.
Sure. Yeah, especially those early years. So we know that the early years of a child is when the vast majority of their brain is being developed. And neglect really does have an impact on brain development. Infants and toddlers and even early preschool age children, they need eye contact, they need touch, they need play. Those are things that we know help their brain to develop, those neurons to be formed. And when a child is neglected, those pathways are not created. And that ultimately does potentially have a lifelong impact on the child. So neglect really, some experts may say that neglect sometimes is more traumatic for a child in the long term than perhaps abuse.
I have heard that as well from experts as well. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So now let's talk about another factor that can influence the behaviors of kids adopted internationally, and that is maternal substance abuse.
Mm-hmm.
That depends by country, of course.
Yes.
But let's talk, and we've got extensive courses and resources available that talk about specifically the impact of maternal substance abuse. And so we won't go into a lot of detail here. But how common is maternal substance abuse, do you find, in international adoption?
Sure. I think it is a common occurrence. And this is another challenge in that we don't always know what the substance has been, whether it's alcohol or other types of drugs, or sometimes even just environmental exposures. It impacts a child in utero. And so that is something that we do often see, and sometimes the behaviors really don't come out until a child is quite a bit older. And so we do have, thankfully, amazing medical experts that are really able to do their best to kind of assess each child and each referral to give us some idea of perhaps if they've had some exposure to substances. And in a lot of countries, we have the birth or expectant parent sharing whether or not there has been exposure to. So there are multiple tools for us to kind of do an assessment on what any kind of substance exposure has occurred.
Mm-hmm. You know, another factor that I don't think we think much about is that oftentimes children who are coming from an institutionalized setting or just even just adopted, even without having been in an institution, have not had much formal education. And yet we bring them to our country and are now putting them in and with the expectation that they're going to eventually catch up. We'll talk about some of that in a minute. But how often do you see that children coming over have had limited educational exposure?
Yeah, I would say most children. And that really, again, has to do more with, resources that are available. If a child is in an orphanage, it's unlikely that, they're able to have access to the public education, or maybe the country doesn't have a very strong education system set up. So I would say for most families to expect that your child will have some sort of delays in education doesn't necessarily mean there are cognitive delays or developmental, mm-hmm. but it will take some time to catch up their education to what is typical here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. All right. And another factor we see is with the act of adoption itself, we are causing a form of trauma, yes. because we are taking a child away from everything they know. Mm-hmm. We are turning their lives totally topsy-turvy. And I think it's important to recognize that because we're talking about behaviors and we're moving into that part of our conversation now, mm-hmm. but just the very act of removing this child from everything they know, all the familiar ties, their surroundings, everything, the smells, the food, the sounds, everything will impact it. And we're going to move into talking about some of the ways that all the factors we just mentioned will influence behavior. Mm-hmm. Let's start with the impact of institutionalization. What are some behaviors that we would see that would be relatively typical of a child who has grown up or spent some amount of time in an orphanage and then is brought over to a family? Let's talk about some of the issues we might expect.
Sure. Upon initial placement, there is going, like you said, Don, I mean, the act of adoption is a traumatic incident. So we have at least two traumatic incidents, the separation from their birth parents and then the act of adoption. So we do prepare parents for a child that has experienced trauma. You add the layer of institutional care, going from that setting to a family setting, that in and of itself is such a significant change in the physical setting that a child is used to. So in orphanages, there is a lot of activity. They are not used to being alone. Mm-hmm. It's perhaps not family style dinners, they're not used to having their own room. Those are things where it's fairly common here in the United States for children to have that. When you're in an institution or an orphanage, that is a very stark difference than what's here. So, initial impacts are just simply the shock of going from that to even a home is going to be a very large transition for the child. So typical behaviors going from that, well, one would certainly, you also have to add in the language barrier. So
thank you. Throw that in as well.
That is the challenge too. And so what we know about kids and really any child is that when they're not able to communicate their needs, they'll find a way. And that might be crying, that might be tantrums, that might be physically hitting or scratching,
It could also be withdrawing. Some children just totally withdraw.
good point. So some spectrum of that extreme, withdraw, hiding, going into a closet, trying to escape, versus all the way to, physically acting out. And all of that is really quite common upon initial transition. And with consistent care, that will likely decrease. It's just that initial trauma, like you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Bless their hearts, really. Think about how scary it must be. Very scary it must be.
And it is. I mean, I can't speak personally, but from having observed and been with some families at placement, it also depends on the age. And right now we have a lot of adoptions occurring at toddler age, 2, 3, or 4. And a typical development of a child during that time is there are some challenging behaviors already. And when you add a change and not being able to understand what is happening, it can really create some challenging behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Some tantruming you would expect. I mean, all of that could be very, very typical.
Absolutely.
Of a child. Another thing we see, and I think it is an impact of institutionalization or an impact of food insecurity, mm-hmm. and that what are some of the typical ways that food insecurity might show up in a child who has been adopted internationally?
Yeah, this can be a wide spectrum too. We could sometimes it's not uncommon to see if there are children that haven't had a lot of food available to them. We've seen hoarding, or eating just if there's tables of food in front of you and you think, oh my, I might not be eating again for another, full 24 hours. I need to really eat as much as possible. So hoarding and eating to the point of sometimes being physically ill is something that we've seen, taking food, hiding it, putting it in their room or places so that they can have it when, they, in the next few hours, because they don't always know when their next meal will be. So that is one type of food insecurity that we can see. Another one is because food is such a large part of our daily life. And when, going from one country to another, being exposed to different foods, some children just simply might refuse. And just if they're sad and withdrawn, they may not have an interest in food either. So I don't know that that is as common, but I have seen and heard of situations like that as well.
What are some typical sleep issues? We know that most children adopted internationally have slept communally, where they've slept with other people or other children in the same room.
Yes.
So what are some sleep issues we see when we bring a child into a typical American home?
Mm-hmm. Disrupted sleep and very irregular schedule. Those are sort of to be absolutely expected for any family. The biggest thing really is upon initial coming to the U.S., is of course the time change. So that is
jet lag.
Yes, jet lag for everyone, the whole
everyone.
Family. And then you add again, we all, when we're stressed or fearful, our sleep is disrupted. And so that it's common. It's something that almost all families should really expect to have some sort of sleep challenges and to have a plan. So finding out as much as possible about what was your child's sleeping arrangement. For example, in Korea, most children sleep with their foster mothers, so they're used to sharing a bed with their foster mother. Kids in orphanages, like you said, they're used to being in large rooms with multiple children. So learning as much as you can about what your child's sleeping environment was like so you can try to replicate that will help with any transition here. But expecting the sleep challenges, which frequent waking, forgive me, I think I already mentioned that.
It's worth mentioning again.
And what we know about everyone's sleep cycle is, they'll have these sort of 40-minute blips of falling asleep and You know, a lot of times, if they're young enough to rock the child to sleep, you'll rock them, put them in their crib, and 40 minutes later, they're up again. And so just my advice is always to create the environment at first that everyone can get the most amount of sleep during that, you know, initial period, 2 to 3 to sometimes 4 weeks, until we're past the jet lag and past kind of that initial shock of where people are. And that is definitely not the time for any kind of sleep training, that's for sure.
Yeah. No, yeah, at this point, this is, you're not forming habits, you're just surviving.
Exactly.
Just trying to, at this point, get as much sleep as everybody can, and then you can work on straightening out sleep habits in the future.
Much later, yes, absolutely.
Much later. Yeah, at this point, we're going to be focusing primarily on helping our children attach to us, and sleep issues we will deal with in the future.
Yeah.
Another impact that we talked about of institutionalization is not understanding the meaning of family. So what does that look like in from a behavioral standpoint?
Sure. Yeah. Great question. So when we think about, you know, being around our family members, there's oftentimes a thought of comfort, right? You think, okay, I'm sitting in a room with my family. We're all sort of doing our own thing, or we're having discussions, or just sitting playing. If you've never been exposed to that, you know, thinking about from the child's perspective, they're coming to this family, but they don't know what that means. That it's really all strangers to them ultimately. So the idea of family is really something that is learned, and it, like anything, it just takes time and kind of exposure to what is typical for your family. So that is something that, you know, the term might can be thrown up, but a child really has no idea until they can kind of live that experience and learn about, oh, okay, so this is what my family now is. I have a, you know, a sister or a brother or a mom or a dog or a dad or whomever. And so that is something that eventually will come. But when you are living in, you know, even a foster home or an orphanage, the idea of family, I think, is different for really everyone. And so that is something that just comes with exposure and is really a learned thing.
One of the other issues that we sometimes see with children adopted internationally are attachment issues. Children who have, it goes hat in hand sometimes with being institutionalized, or it certainly goes together with not having consistent caretakers. So what does attachment, what are the behaviors associated with a child who is failing to attach, or post-traumatic stress? Because they can sometimes mimic each other. So let's separate those. We'll start with attachment. What are some behaviors that parents can identify as that, all right, what I am seeing now, I'm looking at a behavior, and this might indicate that my child is struggling with attachment.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. A lot of that depends too, kind of where they are in the process of placement. So upon initial placement, a few things to observe and not worry too much about, but to recognize, okay, these are attachment challenges that we're going to work on. One that is common from children in institutional care is what we call indiscriminate affection. That is where they will go to any adult. They're, you know, for example, you'll be walking down the street, they see an adult, and they will approach that person. So there's no concept of sort of stranger danger. And that's a learned behavior when you're in, you find an adult who can meet your need. So that is one attachment challenge that is very common upon initial placement. If that lasts, I would say, you know, maybe longer than 6 months after placement, or perhaps 9 months, if your child is still seeking attention from an adult that they don't know, I think at that point it would be the time to perhaps seek some professional advice to see, you know, how can we strengthen the attachment with my child? Because for whatever reason, they're still seeking needs from people outside of their home.
Mm-hmm.
Another way that we can see attachment issues coming out is, let's see, lack of eye contact and not having any desire to be with either parent. Most often a child will attach, if it's a two-parent household, most often the child will attach to one and sometimes can really reject the other parent. And that's very common.
Very common.
Yes. And so those are things to expect. If for some reason a child were not attaching to either parent, not allowing the parents to care for the child without them crying and not being able to comfort the child in any way, again, past, you know, this one, maybe past the first month or two, then there's, that's definitely perhaps a bit out of the ordinary. And I would see that as an attachment challenge for sure to address.
And there's a lot, and even, I mean, there's therapy, of course.
Yes.
But there's also resources on things you can do to help your child attach. There's absolutely resources on
so many.
Yeah, play techniques, fun things.
Yep.
Things that you introduce that are really helping that child to attach. It's nothing to, I think we sometimes immediately hit the panic mode when in fact, what we really need to do is just start deliberately and intentionally working to help our children attach.
Absolutely. And we know the best way to do that is, like you said, through play. I mean, whatever the age your child, trying to find something that they are interested in and getting on the floor with them and using play, you know, if they're young enough, peekaboo and things like that, will eventually, they'll start to see you as a safe person, and play is just one of the primary ways to attach, and the child to see you as the caregiver. Touch is such an important one. Of course, it depends on the age of the child. If this is an older child, that's perhaps not appropriate given their history. It depends, of course. But young children, toddlers, you know, water is a great one. If they like to swim, it's a way to have some touch with the child and have something fun. Although some kids really don't like bath time or water. So again, every child's different. But those are a few ways to kind of use day-to-day activities as a way to really attach with your child.
And even with older children, I still think touch is important. We may need to get their permission for what type of touch feels comfortable to them.
Right.
Some kids, obviously, we want to avoid anything that is too intimate, because that would be inappropriate for an older child. But rubbing somebody's feet or giving somebody a head rub, or at bedtime, if they're laying on their back or their their stomach, you can rub their back, or giving them a shoulder massage.
Yes.
Or sometimes just a pat on the arm with a smile, just some way that you're reaching out and connecting them. Just pat their arm or pat their shoulder, or you know, when you're walking by, and then watch their reaction and see whether it's pleasing or if it's off-putting to them, and try to find a form of touch that is comfortable for them.
Absolutely. Yes, those are great examples.
What are some of the behaviors we might see with a child suffering from post-traumatic stress?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. So this really enters more of where a trauma is having the psychological response to the child is coming out. So for example, if you ever were to see your child, I'm trying to think of some examples here. A lot of times there's a disassociation that can occur if there's a post-traumatic stress response, severe withdrawal, or some parents have talked about seeming that their child is almost just in a different sort of universe, almost like they've completely disengaged. And sometimes that's a protective factor. You know, if every person who has had a traumatic, every person has had a traumatic experience, but every person also responds differently. So the simple act of placement can create a post-traumatic stress response in some children. And so the good news is there are treatments available, and with consistent parenting, there's tons of hope with that. But what might be an indicator that the child has experienced more post-traumatic stress is if there's pretty extreme behaviors that, like physically tantruming or hitting or throwing or complete withdrawal over a longer period of time, you know, not mm-hmm. just a few weeks during those initial transitions, but lasting much longer, that would be more of an indicator of some post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm. Things that and if you notice that there's a particular something that triggers the child, yeah. that's important information, and that would indicate that the child has some PTSD that needs to be worked on.
Yes, and sometimes it might seem like something very small, you know, maybe even a smell of some sort or just a photo of something could spark it. So the longer you're with your child, the more you can recognize those things.
Mm-hmm. And to become a detective to try to recognize it. Sometimes I find that for myself, I need to remember that I need to be looking for the triggers as opposed to because I won't think of it at the time. So I have to be very proactive
yeah.
to try to see it. Yeah. This show is underwritten by the Jockey Being Family Foundation. Hope for the future is what drives the mission of Jockey Being Family, helping to provide crucial post-adoption support to all adoptive families so that they can remain strong and together forever. They believe that every child deserves to experience unconditional love of a family, and they aim to make that dream a reality for all. To help support them and their mission, please visit their website, jockeybeingfamily.com, and click on the donate button, and we thank them. All right, what are some of the typical behaviors and actions that we would see of a child who has prenatal substance, who has experienced prenatal exposure or prenatal substance abuse?
Some typical behaviors. You know, this is I don't mean to be difficult with this. My answer is a lot of it really does depend on the age of the child and really what exposure that the child has had. You know, we know that alcohol is one of the most impactful substances on a developing child in utero. Sometimes FASD, fetal alcohol syndrome or fetal alcohol effect does come out in even physical features. It's not as common as I think we once thought, but
we once hoped, because if we didn't have the physical features associated, we could say, oh, this child will not be impacted. Alas, yeah. that is not the case, is it?
It is not the case. And that is also, we often don't know or have the ability to get a diagnosis of FAE or FASD until the child is quite a bit older. And we've had mm-hmm. years of behaviors to sort of see, okay, now this is typical of a child with some fetal alcohol exposure. But to answer your question, some impacts are ability it impacts the brain. And so what we know is it can impact attention span for a child. It can impact your ability to soothe the child. Some children have just more of a startle response than typical. I'm trying to think of a couple of things here.
Some of the others, I'll jump in here.
Yeah, please.
As you said, it causes brain damage. And oftentimes, it becomes very more obvious when the children enter school.
Yeah.
But even before then, we can often see that these children have more hyperactivity. They have more inability to focus. It can very often affect higher level thinking skills, which usually kind of kick in when the child is entering school or even second and third grade. Before that, the cause and effect, you so often will hear parents say, they don't learn from, they've done this, I've corrected them. They're not learning from their experiences before. Well, that is absolutely a form of brain damage that can be associated with prenatal exposure, especially the prenatal alcohol exposure. So all of those are behavioral things that we often see that there will be a gap and they're strong in certain areas. And so you think, well, let's say that they're verbally they're quite strong, and yet there are other things that their visual spatial is just way behind, or a big gap between their how they behave. They may behave on the level of they may be six, but behaviorally and developmentally they appear more like a 3-year-old. Mm-hmm. Those are all some impacts and of typical behaviors you might expect from a child who has been prenatally exposed.
Yes.
And then, and as the child gets older, we will often see the higher level thinking skills and the cause and effect skills and the inability to manage time and money. All of that becomes something as these children, not every child will have this, but those are typical behaviors.
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you. You're absolutely right. And it's really is something that we're learning so much more about almost every year. Just more information and resources are coming out about how to help parents and kids too, which is really amazing. So
And Creating a Family has resources for all of these behaviors, but we have a lot of resources to help families with prenatal exposure issues. So I will throw that out, creatingafamily.org. Now let's talk a little bit about neglect. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that neglect can sometimes be as damaging or perhaps more damaging even than abuse. So a child who has been neglected, yeah. What are some of the behaviors we might see? Now, that could lend itself to some of the food issues we talked about, but some of the other behaviors.
Sure. Yes. Oh, it's quite common with children who are initially coming into homes who are perhaps neglected to do perhaps some rocking or what might seem like nervous habits sort of over and over, picking of the skin. Self-stimulation is another one. You know, things that the child used to kind of soothe themselves, you know, especially if they were, say, you know, infancy or in a toddler in a confined space in a crib for a long time, children learn adaptive behaviors based on their environment. And so it is quite common to see what people might think as just a nervous habit, but rocking and thrashing sometimes, a lot of times it can come out too at night with thrashing around the crib or calling out or things like that. And that is sometimes can be an indicator of neglect. Physically, a child that's been neglected, they're physically often smaller. Touch is so important in how children grow. And so physically, children who have been severely neglected and even slightly are even smaller in stature. Mm-hmm. Those are all things that initially are things that you can see when a child comes home. In the long term, again, it goes back to brain development. Neglect really does have a very significant impact on the brain and how it develops. And, you know, the first 5 or 6 years of life is essentially, I think, gosh, I don't want to throw it out there without my scientific textbook in front of me, but I believe it's 70 to 80%. If not more, of our brain is formed by the time a child is 5 or 6 years old.
Yes.
So, neglect does really have a pretty significant impact on children and their development and behaviors.
Mm-hmm. If you're adopting an older child, another behavior that we see is the child, we have a name for it, a parentified child.
Yeah.
A child that takes on the role of a parent. This is particularly seen when you're adopting a sibling group.
Yes.
Because it often is the older female, but sometimes not just the older child, has taken on the role of the parent, mm-hmm. of caring for their younger siblings. And honestly, if they were raised in their home, they might take on the role of caring for their parents,
yes.
either emotionally or physically as well. So let's talk about what does a parentified child, what are the behaviors we would notice so we could say that child is acting like a parent?
Yeah.
What are those behaviors?
A great example, you know, when you're adopting siblings, like you said, they're, if they've been neglected, if they've been in a home, the oldest child will take on that role. So what you might see if as they enter a family is that the younger children are not looking to the parents, but they're instead looking to their older sibling for direction. The parentified child will have a difficulty also accepting sort of the adoptive parents' efforts to be a parent. And instead, they've learned and had to have someone sort of take control and make decisions and make food and really be a protective figure for the younger siblings. And so, if you can tell pretty quickly, sometimes we've heard even, kids as young as 6 years old, really sort of being the the parent for their younger toddler, baby, infant, siblings. So, and that has such a big responsibility for young kids to take on. And I think the younger the child or the sibling group, sometimes a little, you know, it may not take as much time for them to sort of see the parents as the parental figures. When we have older sibling groups, and it can be more challenging. And I think the ways to really try to become the parental figure, especially to the parentified child, is really trying to align with them and making sure there's not a power struggle over who's the mom or who's the dad, but instead sort of trying to maybe align with the older sibling to show them that the goal really is to make sure everyone is cared for.
Mm-hmm. You know, and we often we are at opposing ends of viewing it, because we might look and say, this child is not having, by being the air quotes around the word parent, by being the parent, they're not having the childhood they deserve. And there's also and I can't become the parent for this child, for all the children, if someone else is taking over the roles of caretaking. Right. But from that child's standpoint, very often, a couple of things have happened. One, their identity is tied up in being the responsible one, right, being the one who makes sure that the kids get into bed, and being the one who makes sure that they get up and get out the door and all of that. That's part of their identity. Yeah. And it was a survival mechanism. Yeah. It is how they survive. So for many reasons, it could especially as you point out with the children past, you know, very young age, it could become entrenched. And we do have a number of resources at Creating a Family for how to partner with these children, that the parentified child, to help them learn to allow you to take over some of the role.
Yeah.
And without really threatening who they are and their identity.
Absolutely.
And honestly, one of the easier ways is getting them involved with children their own age, because as they become busy and they have Girl Scouts and they've got soccer and they've got, you know, the activities that they're involved with, that's taking them away more. So it's kind of gradually starts happening where they just can't be around to be the parent. As we all know, being a parent takes time, and when you're busy with other things, you don't necessarily have that time.
Right. And as they learn to trust the parents, that, you know, to know, okay, my siblings are going to be okay, because I'm now trusting that these are my parents and they will watch over myself and my siblings. So which just takes time.
It does take time.
A lot of work.
Mm-hmm. And reinforcement and showing up and being there. Right. All right, we've talked a little about abuse and how common it is, but there's one form of abuse that what we hear more about, or people are more afraid, our parents are more afraid of, and that is sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. How common is sexual abuse in foreign orphanages and institutions?
Mm-hmm. You know, it is quite common, and it's not often in the way where we're thinking of even necessarily caregivers being the people who abuse the children, but sometimes it is other children. You know, when you have a number of children in a setting with limited oversight at various different ages in development, you know, things can certainly happen. And so most children have had some sort of exposure to inappropriate sexual behavior. And that can range from something, you know, it's all significant, but there's definitely a range. So I do think we have all of our families prepare and do training about sexual abuse and how it impacts children, because it is a very common thing that happens, sadly.
And I think that there is a misconception that all children who have been sexually abused will then become sexual abusers.
Oh, God.
And that is simply not true.
No.
But and the other thing I think there is a perception that once a child has been sexually abused, they cannot heal past it. And that also is not true.
It is not true. There are so many ways that they can heal. And
absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. And we have a lot of resources at Creating a Family, as well as courses to help families. And so I just strongly encourage you. It is disconcerting, to put it mildly, because it's to see a child acting out sexually.
Yes.
So it is so important that parents be prepared so that they both don't overreact and that they can be the resource that that child needs at that time to help them heal past it.
Exactly. And that many of the resources that you have are exactly what we ask our families to watch and to do the courses and trainings, because like you said, it's really not something that is commonly talked about. And the more we can learn about it, and like you said, if you see a child doing something, we don't want to cause more stress for them. We want to be able to, if something is to happen, that we're prepared, we can see this, okay, this tells me perhaps they've had some exposure to inappropriate sexual abuse, and then we can use what we've learned to help that child and for them to heal.
And to go into especially if you are bringing a child into a family where children are already there, to set up protections for all children at that point.
Yes.
Set up the protections to begin with, set up the rules, set up the expectations, and then don't overreact, because you at this point will have had the expectation and the rules set up, but be vigilant. Yes. You do have to be vigilant.
Absolutely. And prevention is key, because if we know
absolutely
a child is of a certain age and coming from an orphanage or any sort of institutional care, setting up that right away, that's not the time to leave the child in the, unsupervised, for an overnight or something. Those are definitely
absolutely
to prevent. Yeah,
absolutely. Set up rules for privacy, set up rules for not going into other people's bedrooms.
Yes.
Yeah. So have these rules just set up and work with the children that exist that are already in the home to make sure they're clear on what's acceptable and what's not, and what to do if something happens that is not acceptable.
Absolutely.
To come to you and to let you know.
Yes.
All right. Another factor that is a part of is common with children adopted internationally that we talked about earlier is a lack of education. And I think it's been interesting to me. I think somehow there is an expectation, and if a child has had no education, let's say, and they're 8 years old, that they're going to then make up and function on the same academic level throughout their career and will go to college and maybe even, go to Harvard. I think we have to have more realistic expectations for children who haven't had the foundation of education. Mm-hmm. So the child may not catch up, but that doesn't mean that they can't be totally successful in this world. It's just that their success might not be tied completely with academics.
Right, right. Very well stated. And, it's often a challenge we hear from adoptive parents when working with some school districts, not all, many are amazing. There are some districts out there that are perhaps not as flexible about letting a child enter a grade more based on their abilities versus their age. And so those are some conversations that we want families to have with their local school districts before the child comes home. So there is a plan in place. Does the child need an individual education plan? Perhaps is homeschooling an option? And is that something that would work for your family and might be better? Is private school an option? Is that better? By no means am I saying one is better than the other. It's really more about what will work for your family and what are the needs of this child? Because we know a child coming here at the age, like you'd mentioned, the age of 8, and having them enter into second grade is not setting them up for success, because the language barrier, we have the just simply again trauma of the placement, and if they've never been in formalized school, they are not going to succeed in that environment without a lot of preparation before being placed into a typical education setting.
But you do have to look at the child that's presenting herself or himself to you, because there are some kids who thrive in a school environment.
Yeah.
It may be that's, and so that is a good place to put them. And it could be that if the school system, depending on the child, that putting the child with age mates could be better for that child. You just can't have a one-size-fit-all approach. And I also think that sometimes, especially, and I speak for myself in this, educated adoptive parents who have been raised on the concept that education is the key, you know, education is what's going to take you through this world. And so we have such an emphasis on the importance of education. So we get a child who is, academics are not going to be their strong suit.
Sure.
And it could be for any number of reasons. It could be just their innate ability, but it could also be the fact that they miss too many of the foundations.
Right.
And I see parents really struggling with, well, what will happen with this kid? How is this kid going to, you know, the you know, is this kid going to be in my basement for the rest of his life, you know, having dinner every night with us? And so I do think that having a more realistic expectation and a more broad definition of what success can look like is important.
Absolutely. And we know that cognitive ability does not always translate to educational success. You know, we all have different areas of strength. Sometimes that's in a classroom, like you said, some kids absolutely thrive in school, but perhaps others don't. And those foundational years are again important. And you know, it is difficult to quote unquote sort of catch up if you really had no formalized education your whole life.
And we don't want that to set our kids up as failures.
Right.
Because it's okay if you don't succeed academically. There are other ways that you can shine. And let's look for those.
Yes.
All right, I'll get off my soapbox.
No worries.
So what type of parenting is effective at helping kids adopted internationally adjust?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Connection. Connection is key. We often talk about connected parenting, which is a term coined by Karen Purvis. So I can't take any credit in that. But trying to connect with your child first, that is the way to really help with the initial transition into your home. Setting up some, you know, clear expectations. Okay, what is the day going to look like? So any kind of routine that we can create for our kids so that they know what is a day, what's it going to look like? Am I going to get that next meal? Or, you know, when am I going to, you know, go to sleep? What's expected of me at night? So consistency, being physically and emotionally present to our children, you know, in our days of being so technologically connected, you know, those initial transitions up to, you know, even a year, that's the time to put the phone down and trying to physically and emotionally be present with our kids during that time. So yes, the typical parenting, it doesn't always work. And when I say typical, you know, like I was often raised with and many of us were, you know, very sort of consequence-based, that often is not the best way to set up success for children coming to your home through adoption. So therapeutic parenting, I that is a term that is often used. And really what it is trying to meet the needs of your child. So perhaps your child is 5 years old when they're coming home, but developmentally and emotionally, they may be 2 years old. And that is the age then to parent them at 2 years old, not simply because they're chronologically five. So if your child will let you rock them to sleep, that's a great time and a great opportunity for some connection and to build attachment. If your child will allow you to carry them in a carrier, beautiful. That's a time for some connection, physical touch, trust building, and a playing, of course, is again, I've said that many times, but play is just a way to get directly to a child's heart and just having fun. And I always have to say forgiveness too of yourself and your child.
Yes.
Because we as parents always, we will make mistakes. We try our best. Mm-hmm. But you know, the next day you might think, you know, I was really trying my best there, but that didn't work for him or her. So I'm going to try something new. And seeking out your supports. We ask all families before children come home, you know, who are the people and what are some of the supports that you can set up before the child comes home so that if and when things go awry or if and when your family starts to struggle, you don't have to just start to look at all of the resources. You already have it in hand. You know, okay, I can call my social worker, I can call my adoption agency, can call on friends or family or a therapist when needed or the school district, and so that you have your supports already identified, because the first 6 months to a year at home is challenging. And there are many amazing times as well. But yeah, there are certainly some challenges, and it does take a different type of parenting than if a child were perhaps born to you.
And one last thing I would throw in is the ability to slow down and focus and simplify your life for, it doesn't have to be forever, right, but being able to do that, because as you point out, it's time consuming to integrate a child past infancy, well, even an infant too, but a child past infancy, a child adopted internationally, into your home. And some parents struggle with that ability to allow that to be the focus for a period of time. So I think that type of parenting is also quite helpful, that ability to do that.
Yeah, and especially those first, you know, 12 to 15 weeks that you're home and trying to do that cocooning, which is really just keeping your group small. You know, that's not the time to be bringing your newly placed child to a large family reunion, or, you know, that's the time to try and hunker down, like you said, Dawn, slow down, and really sort of try to kind of create the new norm for your family.
Mm-hmm. Guys, let me tell you that Creating a Family, this radio show, as well as all the resources, exists through the generous support of our partner agencies. These are agencies that believe in our mission of providing education support training to pre- and post-adoptive and foster families, and they believe in it, and they put their money behind their beliefs. One such partner is Hopscotch Adoptions. They are a Hague-accredited international adoption agency placing children from Armenia, Bulgaria, Croatia, Georgia, Ghana, Guyana, Morocco, Pakistan, Serbia, and Ukraine. They also specialize in the placement of children with Down syndrome, and they also do a large number of kinship adoptions. So check them out at Hopscotch Adoptions. All right, Leah, what can adoption professionals do to help families and children adapt post-adoption? Changing it up a little, we've been talking about what parents can do and what type of parenting is effective. What type of adoption agency is effective, or adoption professional is effective at supporting parents?
Yeah, great question. Well, hopefully every parent has a social worker that they feel they are connected to, that they can call in any time that they need. We as professionals, I think the more that we can check in with our families, normalize challenges, send out check-ins, you know, say your family has only been home a week, send an email, give them a call. Even if they don't respond to you, keep doing it. We want our families to know that we're there for them if and when they need them. If your agency has a wide website with some resources or perhaps some articles, those are ways to just sort of send to our families, make sure that they know if they're up in the middle of the night, they can open up that email link and think, oh, I think I read something about, you know, this issue. I'm going to read it now. But most importantly, I think, is for our families just to feel supported. And the best way that we can do that is, I think, to educate our families before placement, as well as after, and making sure we're checking in, you know, not just at that post-placement or post-adoption time when the report is due, but instead routinely just knowing that you're available when needed.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. Checking in is we tell parents sometimes half the battle or 90% of the battle is showing up. I think that with professionals too. Right. Showing up, just being connected so that families know to come back to you post-adoption. That is just so crucial and I really think is necessary. And having resources to provide to them is helpful, but sometimes just showing up, Just being there is the most important. Well, thank you so much, Leah Strom, for talking with us today about typical behaviors to expect for children who are adopted internationally. Let me also say that if our audience wants to reach out to Leah or get more information, you can get information at their website, chlss.org, Children's Home Society and Lutheran Social Services. So chlss.org is a way to reach out to get more information about their organization as well as from Leah.
Yeah.
So let me remind people that the views expressed in this show are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of Creating a Family, our partners, or our underwriters. And keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, work with your adoption or foster care professional. Thank you for joining us today, and I will see you next week.